and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Anchorage Museum for the last lecture in the series on World War II in the Aleutians. Recorded on Thursday, February 3rd, Alaska playwright and former Alaska newspaper reporter Peter Porco presents Dashiell Hammett in the Aleutians.
Okay. So my topic is Dashiell Hammett in the Aleutians, and this needs a bit of an introduction, which is to say that he enlisted in the armed forces at 48 years old for a second time. He was in World War I, but as a soldier then. But he enlisted at age 48 in 1942. He enlists in World War I when America enters the war. And the most significant things about it, because he stays in Maryland the whole time. The most significant thing about it is that he gets the Spanish influenza, which aggravates a latent tuberculosis. And this tuberculosis will have a very important effect on him in several ways. But he gets pretty sick. And after the war, he is sent convalescing in Spokane, Washington. And it is here that he meets his wife, the woman that will become his wife, and bear him two daughters. And he is basically in and out of convalescence. He doesn't really ever get better for a while. In fact, he stays pretty... Well, he's real thin. He has a lung ailment all his life. There's an episode in one of his early jobs. He worked as an advertising copywriter for a jewelry company, and at one time he was found. Somebody came into the office, and he was found lying unconscious in a pool of blood. So he would get very sick. He has trouble also with the Veterans Bureau. He's trying to get money. They sometimes think he's only 50% debilitated, and sometimes he is because he can go to work. He goes back to work for the Pinkertons, but at other times he's 75%, 100%. But anyway, he goes back and forth with them. They become a nuisance to him. And it's interesting because when he's in World War II, he's still collecting benefits from the Veterans Bureau when he calls it a gag that he played on them. He goes to a school to write commercially. He wants to learn how to write advertising copy, and that's how he gets a job doing that. And I don't know if you can read everything here, but you see him at about 24 years old as a Pinkerton detective and as a soldier in World War II. He and his wife moved to San Francisco in the early 20s. And, of course, of all the places that he'd been... he never left the country, really, but all the places that he'd been, San Francisco is the city that's most identified with Hammett, because that's where he began to write the fiction that made his name, and he sets a lot of his material in San Francisco. This is what he wrote. This is some bit of advertising copy that he wrote, and again, he's working for a jeweler, so it's called Diamond Dress. Nothing you can wear adds more to your appearance than good jewelry. Tastefully selected, properly worn, it will do for your dress what eyes do for your face. Make it live with points of fire and color. And Hammett, by the way, was not a dandy, because certainly a man who exuded so much of this macho masculinity could not be called a dandy, but he was a very fine dresser. He had exquisite taste in clothes. He bought the best stuff, shoes, clothes, jewelry. This was part of his personality. As I said, he begins to publish a little bit in this magazine called The Smart Set, which is published by H.L. Mencken. He's the editor, and Gene Nathan. But they also have another magazine called Black Mask, and they're beginning to see, it's like a pulp, and they're beginning to see that Hammett's got this style of writing that belongs in Black Mask. So now he begins to write the stuff that will make his name. And I'm just going to read you something called The Farewell Murder, just the opening. This is a novelette, short novel, that he wrote, published in 1930, just at the time that The Maltese Falcon came out, too. I was the only one who left the train at Farewell. A man came through the rain from the passenger shed. He was a small man. His face was dark and flat. He wore a gray waterproof cap and a gray coat cut in military style. He didn't look at me. He looked at the valise and Gladstone bag in my hands. He came forward quickly, walking with short, choppy steps. He didn't say anything when he took the bags from me. I asked, "Kavalov's?" He had already turned his back to me and was carrying my bags towards a tan Stutz coach that stood in the roadway beside the gravel station platform. In answer to my question, he bowed twice at the Stutz without looking around or checking his jerky half-trot. I followed him to the car. 3 minutes of riding carried us through the village. We took a road that climbed westward into the hills. The road looked like a seal's back in the rain. All right. So the big thing about Hammett, and many of you may already know this, but he became known for this hard-boiled style of writing. And somebody has said that he seemed to work at draining every bit of sentiment, every bit of feeling he could out of the world, out of the words. And so that all you get is this world of people just sort of, their animal selves are just below the surface. Something's going on. And again, very hard-boiled. You saw, those of you who saw the clip from the Maltese Falcon, that last bit where Sam Spade is telling Bridget, a woman he seems to love, he says, "I'm sorry, you know, the code is the code. You can't let your business partner get killed." And by the way, he's sleeping with his business partner's wife in the story. But it didn't matter to Sam Spade. What happens is you stay by the code. And, you know, in a sense, Hammett had a strong moral sense. But there are some people who say that actually he didn't really believe that. But I'll leave that for others to decide. So again, he was hard-boiled. Dorothy Parker said he was so hard-boiled you could roll him on the White House lawn. Raymond Chandler said that Hammett took murder out of the Venetian vase and dropped it in the alley. He gave murder back to the people who committed for a purpose, rather than just to provide a body. Jerome Charon, who's a well-regarded American novelist, both a mystery writer and also a in the literary school, said this about Hammett. He said that he spoke about the relentless, muscular rhythm of Hammett's prose. Like Hemingway, Hammett was a master of the untold. It is the space between the sentences that tells most of the story. Hammett invented a kind of hard rock poetry that had no real equal in America. Hammett was our first poet of crime. The great mystery about him, and I don't know if anybody's ever going to solve it, is why did he do all his great writing in only a 12-year period, from 1922 to 1934. By 1934, he publishes The Thin Man. It's his last book. Not the last book that people will make of his writings. They rearrange his writings in every which way to come out with a new book. But it is really the last one that he publishes. And there are all kinds of theories about it. I'm not going to go into that because we want to know why he gets to Alaska and what he does here. Lillian Hellman was a big influence on his life in some ways, the most important relationship of his life. He knew her for the last 30 years of his life. I want to just talk about his wife for a moment. Because he had tuberculosis, the doctors advised him to live apart from his family because he had a young child, two young children, wife. He was contagious. So Hammett went to live on his own in one of those well-known by now San Francisco apartments. And he got to like it. And he also was being unfaithful to her. And he continued to be. And by the time the Maltese Falcon is coming out in 1930, when he is now 36 years old, he's basically, there is no relationship there. He never really stops having a relationship with them, though, in some way. He always provided money for them, not regularly, but he always provided some support for his wife and his two daughters. He bought them a house in Los Angeles, and they lived there. And he will, throughout his life, maintain a relationship with them. But for all intents and purposes, the marriage is over. There's some effort at a divorce later on, but it's over. And now he takes up with Lillian Hellman, but both Lillian Hellman and he are not faithful to each other. They each have lovers. They're each dealing with jealousy. But that's the relationship they had. And something interesting happens with Hellman in terms of her career and his. But again, that's not where we're going. Hammett, in the 1930s, was, I mean, Mr. Glamour. He was one of the most highly paid writers in America. He was very well sought by Hollywood because they could tell a good story. They knew a good story when they saw one. He could write great stories. He wrote screenplays, some of them, but he also was irresponsible and not too reliable. But he was still getting paid very highly. I forget which movie studio had him on contract. The point is that during the 1930s, he was living high on the hog. But Hammett was not someone to save it. He spent it furiously, it seems. He drank incredibly. He was a drunk. I mean, people would find him just outright dead drunk in his hotel room. When Lillian Hellman met him, he was on a five-day drunk. So he just kind of let it all go. One of his close companions at the time said that Hammett didn't seem to expect that he would live much past Thursday. He just didn't have any expectations that there was some life after the next day. He just burned it up, and he said himself, "I intend to live flamboyantly." And some people theorize that that's why he stopped writing, because he got rich on it, no need to write anymore. So, hard-drinking guy, sleeping with all kinds of women. He even got charged by one woman, an actress, a minor actress. She charged him with rape and assault in a Beverly Hills hotel. And he didn't show up for court, so she won a judgment of $2,500 against him. There are stories that he also knocked around Lillian Hellman. So, in other words, this was not Mr. Likeable by any means. But anyway, another thing that goes on in the 1930s is starting with the middle of the decade when things are really getting bad overseas, he becomes a hard left activist. He takes up with Lillian Hellman on this. They're both palling around with communists. Whether or not Hammett actually joined the Communist Party seems immaterial. He certainly did a lot of work for them. He raised funds for them. He wrote letters. He was the one, I think, who began the Screenwriters League. It's the equivalent of the Actors League in California. But anyway, he organized screenwriters. So he was a union organizer in a sense, but he was always from a higher level. I don't think he marched in demonstrations or anything like that, but he certainly lent his name and his money to a lot of causes. He said later in life that he wished he had gone over to Spain to fight in the Civil War there, but he never did. But anyway, and there's some incredible contradictions about this whole business, about Hammett being a lefty and really being independent too, you know, this hard-minded guy, very independent-minded, and yet becoming a sap. I won't play the sap for you, Sam Spade says to Bridget, but yet Hammett kind of played a sap to Stalin in very unusual ways, and that's a real sort of mystery as to why that all happened. But when America gets into the war, Hammett surprises everybody by trying to enlist. He's 48 years old. He's got probably one or two good teeth in his mouth. The rest are all bridges and whatever. And he's rail thin. He only weighs about 140 pounds, and he is rejected. He tries again. He's rejected. The third time, they accept him because there's a manpower shortage. And they're really now accepting a lot of people. And in fact, now they're even starting to build. I was just told this by Chris Rowe, and I'm going to talk about him in a moment. But they're starting to build more black units, all black units, so that they can use the blacks that they're drafting and that are enlisting. They can find a place for them because it's a segregated armed forces. So Hammett is in the military. He spends his first 11 months or so, 10 months, at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. He's got a desk job. He's writing manuals. He eventually gets sent. He wants to go to combat. He wants to be in action, whatever. This is what he's telling people, and he's trying. He's agitating to get sent to a more active unit. And he actually gets sent to Camp Shenango. Now, Camp Shenango it's in Pennsylvania. And it was a training camp, but was also a place where the army put undesirables. They put hard right-wing radicals, Nazis within the armed forces. They also segregated blacks there, and they put lefties there too. And they had stockades. Hammett went there. He didn't spend much time there because Eleanor Roosevelt found out what was going on at Camp Shenango, that people were being kept there because supposedly they were undesirables. So she complained, and eventually people were released, and Hammett was among those. He gets released, and now he's sent to Fort Lewis in Washington, and then he finds out he's being transferred to Alaska, and he is being held up at the port. Now, I learned this from Mike Dugan. Mike Dugan was my colleague and editor at the Daily News, now, of course, a state representative from Spinard. And Mike wrote the first, as far as I know, the first look at Hammett in the Aleutians of anybody in Alaska, as far as I know. And he wrote it in 1987. It was quite a while ago. But anyway, he got to interview some people that were pretty interesting, and he finds out that actually the people, the medics, took a look at Hammett when he's at the port, and they said, "No, sir, you're not going to Alaska." And he insisted, and they let him go. And where he originally winds up is Fort Randall, which is in Cole Bay, and he isn't there for very long before he's sent to Umnak Island, where I'm not sure if he was on Fort Glenn or he was at Cape Field. I think there were two installations on Umnak. And this is now, we're talking now, the summer of 1943. And he spends a few months there, and he really loves Alaska. And I think I'll try to read some of the things he says just in his first letters, his early letters to Lillian Ellman. Just a phrase here: trees, mountains, and ocean make a nice combination. Alaska is one of the few places that looks just like Alaska. Here he's talking about being an infantryman training at his age. Now he's 49 years old. Food note: wild strawberries are plentiful here and large and tasty. We scouted the tundra with one eye alert for a theoretical enemy, the other skinned for berries. After all, one can flatten oneself just as expertly in a berry patch as elsewhere, and eating doesn't interfere with one's alertness. Nobody expects to taste the enemy. One night there were stars. You don't know, that's news. Anyway, his letters were published, a volume of his letters were published in 2001, and believe me, they give you a different view of Hammett. They are just delightful to read. He was really an extraordinary writer. Okay, he eventually gets to Adak. He comes to Adak on September 8th, 1943. Now, at that point, remember that it's only a few months earlier that the Japanese were still in Alaska. They were out on Attu and Kiska. We drove them off of Attu. We find out that they got out under cover of fog from Kiska in mid-August of 1943. In mid-August of 1943, on Adak Island, there were almost 100,000 soldiers. Now, when you think that just a year earlier, in August of 42, I think that was when the Kastner's Cutthroats first went ashore on Adak to scout. They found nobody there. It was about August of 42. In 1 year, the United States military had built an installation for 100,000 soldiers, airfields, all the barracks, and everything, just in 1 year. And they built the airfield in about 12 days. And 12 days after building it, they were able to set bombers off. Compare this to, at that time, let's say 1940, early 1940, the largest town in Alaska was Juneau. It had not quite 5,800 people. So Adak, the installation of Adak, was 15 times larger than the largest city in Alaska. I mean, the whole state of Alaska belonged to the military, and also they imposed tremendous censorship everywhere and all over. Everything going in and everything going out was under military censor's eye. Okay, what was it like for the soldiers once the Japanese were off the islands, once they were driven out and they were no longer in anywhere? Okay, so basically the Aleutian War is over. This is from the Army's own history of the official history of the Alaskan Department. And it's a chapter called Morale, Monotony and Morale. Just a paragraph. A letdown in this, and remember, again, we have no more war. So these soldiers are all there. They're not 100,000 anymore. Now we're drawing them down. And I'm not really quite sure how many were there in September of 43 when Hammett arrived, or how much would be there over the next 16, 18 months that he's going to be associated with Adak. A letdown in the soldiers' morale was followed by a familiar group of symptoms that could be attributed to the partial loss of goal and feeling of unimportance, both in the total war effort and often in relation to his own military status. the more overt manifestations of group discouragement and depression were loss of initiative, disturbances of sleep and of the digestive system, and irritability. The irritability was not easily subdued and expressed itself in argumentativeness and other unsociable conduct. Later symptoms included apathy and listlessness, disinclination to perform any but the most necessary duties, inattention, and a strong feeling of hopelessness. The apathy was often very striking. Some of the soldiers sat quietly hour upon hour when no duties distracted them. One of the people who worked with Hammett on the Adakian newspaper was a guy who later became a poet and a novelist. His name was Erwin Spitzer. And in 1974, for The Nation, he wrote a memoir of his time with Hammett and on the Aleutians. And among other things, he says, in the very beginning, he's talking about the weather, and he says it was the weather, even more than the lack of women, that produced in soldiers what was called the Aleutian stare. In the early days, our company took its meals in the mess of a National Guard company that had been there a year, having arrived with the American invasion on the heels of the Japanese pullout. On my first morning in the mess hall, I thought I had run into a collection of zombies. The guardsmen stared into their plates unseeingly and pushed food into their mouths mechanically. Then, like robots, they stood in line, scraped their plates, handed them in, and marched out dully into the howling snow. Later, I heard the story of a staff sergeant who had entered a mess hall of his own company and machine-gunned his own men. Now, I've heard, read from several sources that ADAC had the highest suicide rate in the Army at that time, and we're all familiar now. We read a lot about soldiers taking their own lives, but I don't know how the public, if the public was hearing about it then, but apparently there was a lot of that going on. I mean, people were really miserable on ADAC, mainly because of the isolation, the weather. There was no town, there was nothing to do. The mud and the weather, I guess, was, as you just heard, overall. Okay, Hammett comes into this situation, and people recognize his talents. They know who he is. One of the things about him is that he never plays on his name. He never sort of says, I'm Dashiell Hammett, do everything for me. He wants to be a grunt like everybody else, like all the other soldiers. But in any case, they know his talents, so they assign him various tasks. As soon as he gets to ADAC, one of the very first things he does is he writes this this book here. It's actually a booklet. It's an account of the Battle of the Aleutians, and his name is down here with Corporal Robert Kolodny, who is this fellow, and I'll talk about him. And, he writes this booklet, and it's Dashiell Hammett. What he really did was, Kolodny, this fellow, is a was a historian, a philosopher of science, a historian of the philosophy of science, and he spoke Spanish fluently and was very learned and so forth. He did a lot of the research. Hammett, and he wrote something up. Hammett rewrote it, as you might expect. I mean, Hammett had the gift for writing, so he wrote the text in this booklet, and Kolodny's captions were there. So what was it for? Mainly to explain to the GIs why they were fighting this war. I could say a whole lot more about Robert Kolodny, but I think he was at Camp Shenango, not about the same time, maybe at the same time that Hammett was there. He too was very strong politically. He was very hard on the left. He had fought in the Spanish Civil War. And again, I'll just go back here so you just get a look at him there. And he actually had been shot right through the head, left for dead. And somebody came along and tried to take his boots, and he wouldn't let him. So he was still moving, and then they finally realized he's alive, and so they helped him. He said that the bullet missed all the vital sectors, but he had a limp, and his hand was sort of disfigured. But anyway, what he's doing there, I don't know if you can see those earphones that he's got on, but he was listening to shortwave radio, which was picking up Axis Nations, Axis Radio. I'm going to read you something. Later on, he would give Sunday night broadcasts on the radio station on ADAC, and he says, I was the Dan, this is Robert Kolodny now, I was the Dan Rather of the North Pacific, except it was very serious business because I also had to monitor the Axis radio stations to give the Washington people an idea of what the propaganda was. See, because in this part of the world, it's always wet, so it's like a gigantic aerial or antenna. You can pick up the whole world on relatively modest equipment. And so he did. And that will help later on, that will help bring news to the Adakian newspaper. And this is a page from the Battle of the Aleutians. Okay, Hammett, one of the other things that he did, and he didn't do this immediately upon arriving on Adak, but he does become, he leads, as you can see, I don't know if you can see, read that bottom, but it says the Dashiell Hammett orientation team. He was training, he called it training, he was training people. He's writing here to Lillian Hellman's, this is a letter, in January of 1944, actually New Year's Day 1944, he's writing to Hellman's assistant. I'm fooling around with training programs again. And in parentheses, he writes, the Hammett-trained soldier will win the war. And at the moment, my principal interests are the causes of the war, the progress of the war, what the people in all countries, including the United States, are bothering their pretty little heads about, how the same folks are affected by the war, what comes after the war, A, international, and B, domestic. Then he talks here about his orientation program. It's designed, now the program I'm working on is designed to tell him, the ordinary soldier, as clearly as possible what's cooking, why we got into this war, and what we stand to get out of it, good or bad, how the war is progressing, and what people at home and any place abroad think of it, what's going on in the U.S. and elsewhere, what people think and do, and so forth. So he, especially in the fall of 1944, he's not even on ADAC, he's touring with this group, and they're spending a week or more in various places, all the installations up and down the Aleutian chain. They're also spending time in Fairbanks, Nome, and Kodiak. Later on, he makes it known, this is after the war, but or toward the end of the war, that he wouldn't mind living in Kodiak, owning a place in Kodiak. He really comes to love Alaska. Okay, but the Adakian, that's kind of one of the most interesting aspects of Hammett's morale-boosting enterprise. How it got started is something that it's hard to nail down. For one thing, you read where the general on the island, who arrived approximately about the same time, a four-star general, I think Brigadier General, so that's not four-star, Brigadier General Harry F. Thompson, was a mystery fan. He knew Hammett, he knew Hammett's work, so the theory goes, naturally, he asked Hammett to start a camp newspaper. There's another story that says that Hammett was bored and he just wanted to, he thought it was a good idea to have a newspaper. So I don't know who started the paper, but suddenly we have an Adakian newspaper. But here's what Hammett said in the very first note, the very first issue. They ran 10 issues that were not distributed. They were just sort of trial run to get these guys used to putting out a paper. He says, first trial run. So this is January 19th, 1944, volume zero, number one. This is not for general distribution. We don't think it's good enough. Neither will tomorrow's be, nor the next day's. After that, we've got hopes. Meanwhile, we're going along on the theory that to turn out a good newspaper, you've got to turn out a newspaper and then keep improving it. And that's what we're doing. We want to give the ADAC soldier every morning a paper that he will like to read, and that will keep him as up to date as possible on what's going on in his world. So that was the beginning of the Adakian. It was printed on mimeograph. Now, at the end of 1944, they finally got a lithograph press, I think it was, or a multilith. But it was always run on a mimeograph up until then. The pages were 8.5 by 14 inches, so they were like legal size. They were printed on both sides. They were ordinary wartime paper stock. And they were done on stencils. They were typewritten. And there are some various interesting aspects of this, and we'll get to them. But anyway, and they worked all night long. And the paper came out in the morning. So it was a daily newspaper. It was printed every single day. They ran off between, over the course of its life, between 3,000 and 6,000 copies.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with playwright Peter Porco. His presentation on Dashiell Hammett in the Aleutians was recorded at the World War II in the Aleutians lecture series at the Anchorage Museum on Thursday, February 3rd.
Hammett seldom wrote. He actually didn't write a whole lot for this paper, although he did apparently over the course of its life write 14 or 15 small articles. And here are two of them. This is another editorial note. It appears January 29th, which is now the first regular edition given to the soldiers. So that's this one on this side. I don't know, you probably can't read it. I'll read a little bit of it. After a few dry run issues to get our hands in, here we go with the first regular edition of a daily newspaper. Our job is to give you, every morning, a newspaper that you'll like to read and that will keep you as up to date as possible on what's happening here, back at home, and in the rest of the world. And later on at the bottom, he says, right down at the bottom there, he says, this is your newspaper. If we ever forget it, lower the boom on us. And then it's signed DH. And then here, on this one, it's an editorial note that appears a few weeks later. And it says, the Adakian plans to run a series of brief histories of the organizations that make up this military community. Organization orientation officers can help us greatly by sending us the following information. Name of organization, when and where activated, outline of history before coming to ADAC, last station, and so on and so forth. So Hammett is reaching out to the community of soldiers on ADAC, the tens of thousands of them there, or however many are there, I don't know exactly, and he's seeking information. He's going to put it in the paper. Here is what is apparently the only set of the Adakian in existence. And I pointed out Bill Glacken, who went on to become the Sacramento Bee. He died in 99. His son, Brendan, I was very lucky to find him and contact him, and I played a hunch. I thought that he, having read the biographies and so forth, I had a feeling that that's where the set of Adakians that one of the biographers alludes to, that's where it was going to be. And sure enough, it was Brendan Glacken who had it. He was very happy to hear from me, and in a way, because I was writing a play, and he thought his father would love the idea that you're writing a play about Dashiell Hammett, because his father was a drama critic, a theater reviewer, and so forth. And I got a grant from the Alaska State Council on the Arts to travel to San Francisco, and I went up into this law office on about the 30th floor of this building, and he hands me this box. You can see the cardboard box, and there it is. And this has got a little bit of an interesting history. I didn't know this because I didn't count it, but I spent every day for about, I think it was 4 or 5 days, not up in that conference room, but in a stock room, a windowless stock room, going through these and taking lots of pictures of them. And they weren't in any kind of order, and they're kind of frail, as I said. They're just ordinary wartime stock. But they're incredibly valuable. And the reason why I say that is because, not just because Dashiell Hammett was the editor of it and helped create it, maybe he created the whole thing, or Bernard Kalb worked for it, a great journalist, guy with a great career, or Don Miller, a noted artist, but just the fact that they give the soldier's viewpoint. Now, there are other military post papers that come off of other military posts, including ADAC. There's something called the Husky Herald. I've seen one or two issues of it. It didn't have at all anything like the sophistication or even the layout sophistication of this paper. But anyway, so Brendan Glacken has it, and he's got this copy. He says, oh, yeah, my father has this. He had this pile of papers. So I asked to see it, and there it is. He brings it in this cardboard box, and it's wrapped up in plastic. And I spent 5 days looking at it, and I tell him, I says, you got to do something with this. You got to give it to a library or something. Well, he finally did, and only just several months ago, it was bought. Oh, a Berkeley rare book seller claims that it is the only set in existence, this kind of a set where it is nearly full, and that it was worth about $20,000. So it was sold to Yale. I don't know what the selling price was, but Yale now has it. It is now in the Yale collection of Western Americana at the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library. And the librarian, the curator of that that collection, tells me that Hammett and Kalb make it important. He didn't mention Miller. I don't know how much he knows about Don Miller, but it's one of several in their collection of Western Army Post newspapers. And anybody who goes to Yale can look at it. You know, you just go up there and tell them you want to look at it. You don't have to have a pedigree of a scholar or anything like that. Okay. Just going to kind of briefly tell you what was the Adakian. Okay. It was big, of course, on printing war news. I wanted to tell the soldiers everything that was going on in the war, and they were telling them all theaters of the war, Asia, North Africa, of course, obviously, the European conflict in the Pacific. So the way they did it was, you can see here that they scratched the headlines in... they scratched the headlines by hand, drove them and did it that way. This, by the way, is the... I was told by this librarian that they don't have the very first trial run issue, volume zero, number one, but this is volume zero, number two. So it's the second issue ever produced. And let me see, hold on. Now, that's the one on the left is volume zero, number two. The one on the right is volume one, number six. So this was this one was a distributed one. It got the other soldiers saw it. Then this, both of these pages, I think they're three and four of the very second issue. Now, again, down here on the lower left and up here on the upper right on the other page, cartoons. Those cartoons are big, and I'll say more about them later. These are June 5 and June 6, 1944. What you read, of course, here is Rome has just fallen, and then this, of course, is the big D-Day invasion. So again, they're printing up everything they can. What you see here is the bottom of page four, the last half of page four, two things I want you to point your attention to. So over here is the WXLB. That was the ADAC radio station. And what you're looking at is the radio listings for the day. So the headline is for that radio schedule are Joe DiRita and Marvin Manzel, Bob Hope and Rochester. We've got Andre Castellanos at 12:30. There's GI Journal at 3 o'clock, Gildersleeve at 3:30, Judy Garland at 4:05, Xavier Cugat at 4:30, and so on. And now these names are quite old. I mean, there might be people here who remember them, but I know they're pretty foreign to a lot of people. But Amos and Andy, 8:30. Don Miller's wife Judy told me that Don Miller objected to Amos and Andy. He didn't like the fact, because he was racially conscious, and he didn't like the fact that they were having Amos and Andy. Okay, down at the bottom here, the staff box. And there's his name right there, Corporal Dashiell Hammett. And it just says, editor. He's not listed with any kind of special fanfare. He's there like everybody else. And it says, the Adakian uses Associated Press, Army News Service, and Camp Newspaper Service material, as well as the facilities of the WXLB newsroom. Okay, so some of the stories you're seeing here, this is from a May 12th and May 13th, 1944 pages. This one here, you see where it says WXLB picked up a Moscow broadcast which said that Marshal Tito's partisans, et cetera, et cetera. Under the headline Crimean Score, we see WXLB picked up a report from Moscow. So Robert Kolodny is picking up stuff from all over, and he's... learning a lot, so much so that with his Sunday night broadcasts, and he writes, eventually he comes to write a Sunday column for the paper about what's going on in the war and so forth, the brass, the general staff, want him to give them briefings. And every Thursday, he would walk over this, somebody called it this kind of meek private, no, he wasn't a private, he was actually a corporal and then a sergeant, but this meek little professorial type walking along the duckboards toward the general staff headquarters, where he would give briefings to the brass on what was going on in the war. He was telling them. But anyway, they were able to get a lot of news because of that. I just want to point out something here. I don't know if you heard Dirk Spinneman's lecture. He was standing right here in this spot 2 weeks ago, but it was great, about the guns of Kiska. But he also knows something about printing, and so he told me, the thing I wondered about was, how did they get the columns to justify? You've got these guys working with typewriters. They don't have computers. Computers do it for us today. They got typewriters, and they're doing it on stencils, too. How did they get it to justify? And they, you know, they do it all the time. So, but Dirk kind of illuminated this for me. And he said, well, they basically The type is what's called monoface, monotype. Every letter is the same exact width on the typewriter. And so basically they were written out in hand, he said, and then they were typed. And the Adakian did have a typist. His name was Dick Jack. And so what I'm beginning to believe is that that's right. Dick probably typed out the stuff after other people had written it. But it's also possible that people or other people had typed it. They typed it and he retyped it, but he spaced it to get justified. Not a major point, but still sort of kind of interesting. Okay, so here's a cartoon showing that they finally, on December 11th, 44, they finally get their multilith printing press, and Hammett was very big on this. He would write in his letters, oh yeah, that press is coming, that press is coming, we're going to do great things with it. He was, back in July, he was agitating for it, but it finally came in December. This is the Sunday ad that they put, two extra pages on Sunday, so you had a six-page paper, and there's Robert Kolodny's war news. He's writing about General Charles de Gaulle then. Okay, page two, a variety of stuff. Cartoon, stateside news, more about stateside, Roosevelt, then Wednesday baseball scores. I mean, you see all kinds of mixed things sometimes, but actually there seemed to be, over the time, there was a kind of a pattern. Movie reviews. These were just capsule reviews. They were a delight to read. I don't want to take too much time because we're running out, but they were they're really brightly written, really well written. And this is interesting. Who knew this? And I learned it from reading the Adakian of March 8th, 1944. It says, the headline says, the first guy that mentions it, and this is an Army News Service story out of New York, it says, William P. Hitler, 32, nephew of Adolf Hitler, reported to his draft board Monday and was assigned to the U.S. Navy. He, and then it explains, he is the son of the Nazi leader's half-brother, Alois. Who knew? Hammett wrote commentary, and the one on the left, he bought a lot of war bonds. And for a guy who was a communist, this is kind of funny. He says, war bonds aren't for fun. They are good, solid investments for people who want to save money, and they ought to be thought of that way. I suppose comic posters and snappy slogans, you'll be fond of your bond, must sell some bonds, or they would not be used so much. But don't try to tell me that anybody's sucking money out of U.S. Steel with gags. And it's the U.S. Steel Corporation and its brothers in big business who buy the bulk of the war bonds, many times the amount bought by individuals. Why do you suppose that is, chum? This one, though, gets me. This strictly political commentary by Dashiell Hammett. Okay, so it opens up with an AP dispatch from Washington, the Democratic National Committee, giving a powerful shove to the draft Roosevelt movement within the party, called on FDR to, quote, continue as the great world humanitarian leader, close quote, in both war and peace. After selecting Chicago as the site of the National Convention and installing youthful Robert E. Hannigan, hailed as the second Jim Farley, as national chairman, the committee members roared approval of a resolution declaring that the liberal spirit and far-sighted idealism of Roosevelt must be impinged in the peace. Now comes a bracketed, a parenthesis from Dashiell Hammett. Listen, chum, this is no time to be starting that. I'm writing it down just as we got it from AP. So you don't understand what that means? So what? So I don't either. So I'll give you 6-2 and even that FDR doesn't understand it. Can he help it if politicians talk like that? Can I help it if I do not always know what's going on in civilian heads? Anyhow, they're going to have $100 a plate dinner tonight while I'm eating Spam. He had a great sense of humor, there's no question. And that's why he gets into the cartoons. Okay, so I mentioned to you some of the people in this newsroom. And again, this is Al Sykes. This is Bill Glack, and he becomes the editor when Hammett's not around. He's the managing editor. There's Hammett. And here's Don Miller, African-American. And this is Alva Morris. And then there's Bernard Kalb. Don Miller wrote illustrated lots of children's books, and went to Africa. He's very well known for his African paintings, paintings of African scenes. And maybe perhaps he's best known for this, which is a, this is just a piece of the Martin Luther King, the mural in the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Library in Washington, D.C. It's 7 feet high and 56 feet long. And there's Don, probably in 1986 when it was dedicated. Yeah, and he, great story. And here's one of the stories I'm going to tell you about Don Miller is that in August of 1989, August 17 to be exact, he stood exactly right here. He was a visiting lecturer. He gave the Herb Hilscher Memorial Lecture here. And he had a, there was a display going on at the time called Drawing the Lines of Battle. And it was about art that was related to the war in Alaska. And there are some original works of his that are still owned by the museum. And if you go upstairs to the Adak and Kiska exhibit, Kiska and Adak up there, you will see cartoons by Don Miller that he did when he was on the Adakian staff. And anyway, he said that Hammett broke the rules by hiring him and Alva Morris, two black guys. I know because Chris Rowe, who is an Army vet and also writing a master's thesis on the culture of the Army in World War II, I just recently learned this the other day that, I mean, it confirmed what I had thought. The World War II Army was as segregated as they came. There were blacks, but they were in their own units. And there was some relaxation toward the end of the war. Manpower is short, so they're willing to kind of play loose. Remember that officially they were not desegregated until 1948 when Truman did so by executive order. But yet Dashiell Hammett went out and hired these two black guys. And now I was pretty sure because I learned it from Judy Miller, Don Miller's wife, and also from Brendan Glacken, because Brendan Glacken said that he was very proud of the fact that his father had worked on this paper where they took the first steps to integrate the armed forces, very small scale, two guys out of a staff of 10, 12, but it was something. And don't know that that Hammett got any flack for it, but if he got flack, he wouldn't have cared. He didn't care what the brass thought of him. And he's well known. There were legendary stories of him telling the brass, you know, to go shoot the breeze or something. So he did that. Bernard Kalb. Okay, so I'm talking to him just the other day, to Bernard Kalb. So I said, what about integrating the unit? Wasn't that kind of a revolutionary thing? He says, I have no recollection of that being a calculated decision at all. I don't know that they were living with us. I don't know if we all shared a Quonset hut. You're giving too much emphasis to that. It didn't occur to me. To me, these were two guys. One was an artist, one ran the stencil machine, and that's it. I have no idea of integration. This little tiny island with the whole thing abandoned, the Japanese retreated, we're in the top of the Pacific. The war is going on in the South Pacific. We are so far out of the war, it's unbelievable. I didn't have any idea we were part of a racial revolution. He's just a great guy. He really is. As I said, I pointed out to him, well, you saw him. Now, here he is. This is the Bernard Kalb that many of you may be familiar with. That's him. That's his brother Marvin, 8 years his junior. They both worked for CBS News. He went on to do, he was a foreign correspondent. He basically traveled all over the world, so much so that he got to hang out a lot with George Shultz when George Shultz was Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State in the mid-1980s. At some point, George Shultz, well, I don't remember how it happened, but he says, okay, I will become the Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs. So he becomes the State Department spokesman. And, you know, reporters are really usually, especially big name reporters like that, they're very reluctant to go over to the other side and become what we call flacks, basically giving the news, giving a spin on the news. Why he did it, he told me, was because he respected George Shultz. He said, George Shultz was on the level, he was an honest guy. So while Bernard Kalb is the Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, he reads that there's going to be a dedication in Washington, D.C. of the Martin Luther King Memorial Library. And he says, I got to go to that. And because he knows Don Miller's going to be there, and he hasn't seen Don Miller since ADAC. So he goes there, and he shows up wearing a cowboy hat because he wanted to be in disguise. He sat with Miller's family, and they say, who are you? Oh, I'm from the White House. So eventually, the ceremony is over, and he goes up to Don Miller. And then he tells Don Miller that he's working for Reagan, working for the administration, and Miller gives him hell. He says, what the heck are you doing that for? Well, 10 months later, Bernard Kalb gets up one morning and he reads in the newspaper that the State Department, with the connivance of George Shultz, has engaged in a disinformation campaign against Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. He gets up on the podium to the press that day and he says, guess what, boys, I'm quitting because of this. So he quit just like that as soon as he heard it. He kept to his principles. He says, we can't do that. That's not the way the United States of America does business. We're not going to do it. Even though George Shultz, it was psychological warfare and worth it. Gaddafi was a dictator. And at that time, well, I don't know. I don't know if he had nukes or was trying to get nukes or anything. But anyway, so that's what happened to Bernie Kalb. Now, bear with me for a moment. So that's Bernie Kalb and sort of interesting story. Okay, Hammett. As the cartoon writer, the hard-boiled detective writer, writing gag lines for cartoons. So this is a letter that he, written to Lillian Hellman, 6 February, 1944. I'm quoting just an excerpt. He says, me, I sit around and think up ideas for gag cartoons. One of the eagles on a colonel's shoulders lays an egg there. A non-com lies sleeping in bed with his stripes sewed on a comforter over his arm. A rat coming down a rope from a ship says to one behind him, go back, this is the Aleutians. A bedraggled raven swoops down saying to another, look, I'm a dive bomber. A bottle of milk and a morning paper stand at the door of a Quonset hut. A soldier sits on his bunk dressing, saying, I dreamed about Evelyn again. Gee, travel improves her. And on and ho-hum, on and on. Sometimes I think I've missed too many boats. So, yeah, he loved to write these gag lines. He got his inspiration from The New Yorker. Now, there was another very famous set of cartoons at the time, well, one of many, and that was by Bill Malden. And Bill Malden was the creator of the Willie and Joe series. But Willie and Joe were combat soldiers. They were really bedraggled, and the GIs loved to look at them and saw a reflection of themselves. These cartoons are just almost 95%, 95 or more percent, related to life on the Aleutian Islands. All right? So we have here, so a cartoon, these two guys walking. And the caption is, all I want is to hear high heels clicking on a cement sidewalk. Now, I just know that's a Hammett line because, you know, high heels, a concrete city, urban landscape, it's got to be him. All right. So one guy to another says, all right. So they got mud in France too, but they also got France. He's in the Aleutians. I think that's something like the army. It's one of my favorites. So sleepwalkers getting up. One guy's about to say something to him. One of his partners and the other one says, leave him alone. Last time he brought back a case of beer. Streptococcus? No, Aleutians. So they printed an average of 3 cartoons an issue and they came up with more than 1,000 cartoons over the life of the paper while Hammett was there. At least that's I've heard that said somewhere. Well, at a certain point in late 1944, he says, let's put together a booklet. And the 3 major cartoonists, Bernie Anastasia, Oliver Pedigo, Don Miller, each selected 50 of their works. And they put it in a booklet called Windblown and Dripping. And the booklet is about 5 inches by maybe 7 or 8 inches wide. And it's got 150 cartoons, 50 by each of them. And there's no publisher. It's just, this is what it says. And then there's a dedication page. And that's all there is. And who knows how many copies were printed. They're still available online. You can still find them. There's one I know is going for about $1,500, but they're available for much less than that, too. And I heard that George Sullivan, who was our former mayor, late former mayor here, was a soldier on ADOC, actually. He saw Dashiell Hammett, according to Mike Dugan, although he never met him. But he owns a copy of Wind Blown and Dripping. Getting toward the end here, Hammett did have a life in Anchorage when, especially, well, he, of course, when he made his tours, he would get here. And when he was here, he hit the bars. He had a nightlife. He loved nightlife. I mean, Mr. Hollywood. And so he, then after about spring of 45, he was stationed here until that summer, I think. He eventually left Alaska in September of 45. But anyway, he invested in a bar, nightclub, and it has been written by one of his biographers, by Mike Dugan, that the name of the bar is the Carolina Moon. And I forgot who I talked to, but she worked for the city planning department and said they could not find evidence of a Carolina Moon. But then someone who met Hammett here, when he was here, and in fact may have dated him, said the bar was Corrine's, and that, I mean, it was known that whatever bar Hammett invested in, he eventually gave it to the woman, the black woman, who ran it for him. But it appears to be the case that the bar was Corrine's and that this is Corrine Benny. And it also, from what I was told by this woman who, well, it's the niece of the woman, she told me that her aunt said that she was out with Hammett one time and he left her and he went into the back room and she waited and waited and waited, what's going on? And she went back there and he was having his fun with Corrine. So that was Hammett, and this is Joe Lewis. He loved boxing, and Joe Lewis came up to do demonstration fights and organizing and organize an Aleutian-wide boxing tournament. So that's almost it. There were a number of memoirs that have been written. This one is not so much a memoir as a report by Yank, which was a soldier's newspaper. Nationwide, published only a few months after he was discharged. They did a story about him. A couple of other things. He, despite all his trouble with, and the FBI, by the way, I didn't even get into that, but the FBI was after him for years. But he was buried in Arlington National Cemetery, and there it says on his gravestone, it says Samuel, oh, one of the things I didn't tell you was that his first name was Samuel. So the troops, his fellow Adakian staffers called him Sam, or they called him Pop. No one called him Dash, though he was known as Dash, and certainly Lillian Hellman called him Dash. So his tombstone says Samuel D. Hammett, Maryland, Tech 3, I think it says, and I think that's HQ for Headquarters Company. He was attached to Headquarters Company, Alaskan Department, World War One and Two. And then the dates of his life and death. One other thing. Next month, an unpublished Dashiell Hammett story is coming out in The Strand. The Strand is a magazine I had not heard of until this news came out, but apparently it's a mystery magazine or prints mysteries, and the story is called So I Shot Him, and it's coming out. And that's it. Thank you very much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with former Alaska newspaper reporter and playwright Peter Porco. His presentation on Dashiell Hammett in the Aleutians was recorded at the World War II in the Aleutians lecture series held at the Anchorage Museum on Thursday, February 3rd, 2011. The lecture series concluded on February 3rd, but the exhibit on Kiska and Adak, War and the Aleutians, is on display at the Anchorage Museum through Sunday, February 20th. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.